Exawos Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The U.S. warns Russian airstrikes in Syria are counterproductive. U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter says Russian airstrikes in Syria hit areas that probably did not contain Islamic State targets. And he told reporters Russian intervention represents a logical contradiction.
One of the reasons why the Russian position is contradictory is that exactly the potential for them to strike, as they may well have, in places where, in fact, ISIL is not present. Others are present. And this is one of the reasons why the result of this kind of action will inevitably simply be to inflame the civil war in Syria.
U.S. defense officials say Russia bombed near the western Syrian city of Homs Wednesday. The opposition Syria National Coalition said there were 36 casualties, all civilian. An alleged al-Qaeda-linked Islamist militant, Ahmed al-Faqi al-Mahdi, accused of destroying a heritage site in northern Mali, faced the International Criminal Court for the first time Wednesday. Carrie Ann Comer of the International Federation for Human Rights told the tribunal Faqi may be guilty of other crimes.
An assortment of Malian human rights organizations have lodged a complaint within the Malian justice system against Mr. Faqi and 14 others, alleging serious sexual and gender-based crimes, in addition to atrocities such as cultural property destruction. These atrocities include rape, sexual slavery, and forced marriage, amongst others.
Faqi, a Tuareg leader of the group Ansar Dine, is accused of war crimes over the deliberate destruction of buildings at a UNESCO-listed desert heritage site in Timbuktu, overrun by jihadists in early 2012. This is VOA News. Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas told the UN General Assembly session Wednesday that Palestinians are no longer bound by the two-decade-old Oslo peace agreements with Israel. He accused the Jewish state of refusing to release Palestinian prisoners while creating new settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Meanwhile, European Union Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini announced yet another international effort to restart the Mideast peace process.
Our envoys to the quartet have been working together very hard in this last month. They've been visiting together a certain number of regional key actors, in particular Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, to restart the engine of the peace process and focus on what is probably the most viable, maybe the only viable way today, which is focus on concrete steps on the ground, and in particular on encouraging the parties to start implementing the already signed agreements.
Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu said the Abbas speech was, quote, deceitful and encourages incitement and destruction in the Middle East. Another explosion rocked China's southern Guangxi province Thursday, a day after more than a dozen other blasts killed at least seven, wounded more than 50. State media reports, quotes authorities as saying a 33-year-old man is suspected of carrying out the bombings. Officials have yet to confirm a motive. Among the targets, a shopping mall, jail, supermarket, rail station, hospital, and open-air market. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon appealed to the world Wednesday to approach Europe's refugee crisis with creativity, compassion, and courage. He said the future does not belong to those who seek to build walls or exploit fears, and called on Europe to do more. But Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who attended the meeting in New York, warned there are limits.
At the Hungarian borders, they are coming from Syria, Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and most recently from the sub-Saharan region. Let me make it absolutely clear, Europe will not be able to carry this burden on her own.
Some European countries who at first opened their borders to migrants have now sealed them or have reimposed visa rules and checks on asylum seekers. There are heightened fears of renewed civil war in Central African Republic following days of sectarian clashes in the capital Bangui that have resulted in at least 39 deaths, dozens being wounded, and tens of thousands who fled their homes. UN expert Marie-Thérèse Keita-Bokum Wednesday warned the Human Rights Council in Geneva the violence must be contained. The CIR was thrown into chaos 2 years ago when Muslims League of Rebels seized power. Hurricane Joaquin has been upgraded to a Category 3 storm as it approaches the Bahama Islands. The U.S. National Hurricane Center said late Wednesday Joaquin's winds have increased to a sustained speed of some 185 kilometers per hour. The center says the storm may turn northwest after passing through the central and northwestern Bahamas. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Thursday, the first day of October, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Thousands march in South Africa against corruption.
The highlight of the protest was to tell the government that we are kind of sick and tired of this corruption that is destroying this young democracy in South Africa.
Joseph Matunjua is the president of the Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union of South Africa. Malawi's government meets at resistance as it tries to remove so-called ghost workers from its payroll. Political turmoil deeply affects Burkina Faso's economy, and the World Health Organization says expanding therapy could end the HIV/AIDS epidemic.
We also believe that by starting more people earlier on therapy, we will have an opportunity to end AIDS by 2030.
Meg Doherty is the WHO coordinator for HIV/AIDS treatment and care. Zimbabwe launches its solar energy policy. International media scramble to cover this year's UN General Assembly news. And Somalia's Al-Shabaab militants move to quell dissenting voices. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A South African labor leader says corruption in the country has made it difficult for workers and the poor to realize the promise of a better future. Joseph Matunjua, president of the Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union, says South Africa's poor remain mired in poverty because of corruption. This came after thousands of people demonstrated Wednesday in Pretoria and Cape Town against rampant corruption in the country. Matunjua says the purpose of the protest was to tell the government of President Jacob Zuma that South Africans are sick and tired of corruption, which he says is destroying the country's young democracy.
The highlight of the protest was to tell the government that we are kind of sick and tired of this corruption that is destroying this young democracy in South Africa, in particular in the government and further in the private business. This corruption that has been left unattended and people stealing from the poor of the poorest in South Africa.
How bad is the corruption situation in South Africa?
Each and every government, surely they do have such challenges. But to our young democracy, we feel that this corruption is severe. In 21 years in democracy, we see that our government is not doing very much in trying to combat this chronic disease called corruption in South Africa. We've seen many senior government officials being given the golden handshake of about 17 million, others 3 million, and some of them, they've been suspended on full pay for more than 2 to 3 years. It's really appalling that each and every community is up in arms fighting for service delivery, for water, the basic needs of which our constitution is suggesting that is your basic right. We believe that with the money that we have in the country, it can afford those basic needs of the people of South Africa.
Are all the unions behind this movement, or this is just a select group of people?
The COSATU as a federation hasn't supported this, but some of their affiliates, unions, they did support it, of which maybe they might be faced with disciplinary action after that. Most then will be us, which are non-aligned union, of which we were supported. But because the NEDLAC, which is a body that represents labor and business and the government, never granted the permission for the workers to be out of work today as a day of demonstration.
To what degree is this movement, this demonstration, this protest against corruption, is this also targeted at President Jacob Zuma? Some time ago, there was an allegation that the president spent almost $24 million or so to renovate his residence. Of course, the parliament said the president did not have to pay back any money. So to what degree is this protest against the president?
Any form of corruption within the government, the executive, we are saying this corruption must come to an end because it doesn't advance South Africa as a country and its people. And this is also go to private business. As you'll remember, that many of these multinational companies in South Africa, in the mining, they are highly involved in price fixing, illicit flow funds from South Africa to some of the safe havens. We used to call it Bermuda connection, where they don't pay tax.
Joseph Matunjwa is the president of the Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union of South Africa. He was speaking with me from the coal mining city of Witbank, about 130 kilometers outside of Johannesburg. The Malawi government is the latest African country to undertake a head count as it seeks to remove ghost workers from its payroll, following in the footsteps of countries like Kenya, Nigeria, and Cameroon to root out waste and corruption in public finances. But as Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre, civil servants say the requirements are excessive.
The Malawi government is demanding civil servants submit original academic and professional certificates, letters of employment, identity cards, recent payslips, and bank statements, among other documents. The workers must present police reports if any documents were lost. President of Civil Servants Trade Union, Servas Sakala, says the demands are unfair.
No bank will give a settlement for free. They range from maybe 1,500 up to somewhere there. We feel this is unnecessary burden to a civil servant who is getting a very low salary.
The union has filed grievances to the Civil Service Reform Commission and told workers not to present documents. Lawrence Jinkunta is a spokesperson for the National Audit Office conducting the exercise.
Yeah, those things have been discussed with the relevant authorities, but we know what they're doing. But we cannot disclose exactly what has prompted us to do that. But we know that it's very, very relevant for us to also cross-check on the bank statement.
As for those who don't comply, Jinkunta says it will be up to the authorities to decide at the end of the month-long exercise. A recent government audit showed the problem of ghost workers to be widespread. A similar exercise conducted by the Minister of Education in the 1990s led to thousands of fake teachers' names being wiped from the payroll. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Political turmoil in Burkina Faso over the past year has taken a toll on the economy. The transitional government is reporting nearly $70 million in losses in the 10 days that follow a short-lived coup by members of the presidential guard earlier this month. The crisis closed businesses and workers went on strike. With elections on the horizon, Emily Yob reports on what a return to political stability can do for the country's economic recovery.
This market in Burkina Faso's capital city, Ouagadougou, is buzzing with activity again after recovering from a failed coup earlier in September that paralyzed the activity for more than a week. Ibrahim Ouadraogo is a hawker and says during the coup he could not work.
We couldn't go out to sell because soldiers were in the streets, so we couldn't go out of our homes.
The country's borders were closed for a few days. A lot of workers went on strike to protest the coup. Hélène Traoré-Sanou works at a cotton company. Burkina Faso is the top cotton producer in Africa, and cotton is a heavyweight in the country's economy. Traoré says her business has not been affected by the recent crisis, but it will be if there is unrest during the upcoming presidential elections, which are due to happen later this year.
Nous avons près de 900 camions.
We have close to 900 trucks driving around the country to fetch the cotton, so we really need the roads to be functional in order to get the cotton to our factory.
This is the latest political crisis in months of turmoil in the West African nation. 1 year ago, massive protests ousted President Blaise Compaoré after 27 years in power. A transitional government was put in place in order to organize elections. Fiscal lawyer Daouda Diallo says these political changes have affected the trust investors had in Burkina and that upcoming elections are crucial.
New authorities will have to give some sort of guarantee to the international community, not only to help them decide to bring funds to Burkina Faso, but also to attract investors in order to take charge of the country's economy again.
Earlier this year, the IMF projected a 5% growth for Burkina in 2015, 2 points below previous projections. Emily Yob for VOA News from Ouagadougou.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Thursday, the first day of October, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's give a shout-out to listeners on our affiliate station, Capital FM, in Blantyre, Malawi. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. The World Health Organization is publishing new guidelines on the treatment of HIV/AIDS that it says could end the epidemic by 2030. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
In a significant departure from current practice, the World Health Organization recommends that anyone infected with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, should begin antiretroviral therapy as soon after diagnosis as possible. In an interview with VOA, Coordinator for Treatment and Care for HIV/AIDS, Meg Doherty, says clinical trials show early use of antiretroviral therapy keeps people with HIV living longer, healthier lives while reducing the risk of transmitting the virus to partners.
We also believe that by starting more people earlier on therapy, we will have an opportunity to end AIDS by 2030. And ending a public health epidemic does not mean that there will be no evidence of the virus at all, but it will mean that there will be an ability to have fewer new infections than those who are on therapy at the same time, and that there will be fewer and fewer people being infected over time.
The World Health Organization also recommends preventive antiretroviral treatment should be offered to people at substantial risk of HIV, such as men who have sex with men or injecting drug users. It adds this preventive therapy should be part of a comprehensive package of services, including HIV testing, counseling, and support. An estimated 15 million people are on antiretroviral therapy. Based on the new recommendations, this number would expand to 37 million people, a target the WHO says it hopes to reach by 2020. Meg Doherty says it would cost $18.4 billion every year over the next 5 years to expand access to treatment services. But she says every dollar invested in HIV treatment would return $15 in improved health and fewer infections and could help avert 21 million AIDS-related deaths by 2030. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Zimbabwe's government has launched a solar energy campaign as it battles to find a solution to its perennial power shortages. The government hopes to cut residential power usage by 40% through increased use of solar. Sebastian Mofu has details from Harare.
Energy Minister Same Undenge announced the policy Wednesday, a week after state power utilities ESA restricted most homes to 6 hours of electricity per day. Much of Zimbabwe's power comes from the Lake Kariba hydro plant. The lake's water level has dropped drastically in recent years, affecting the power supply for both Zimbabwe and Zambia. In an interview, Undenge outlined the situation.
Kariba Dam, the water level has gone down, so we are no longer generating the power we used to generate. At Kariba Power Station, we used to generate 750 megawatts. Now we are down to 475 megawatts.
Zimbabwe also generates electricity from coal-powered plants, but still produces less than half of the 2,200 megawatts a day it needs. Undenge said imports of electricity are not averting the shortages, hence the push for solar energy. Masimba Kushera is from the Zimbabwe Coalition Debt and Development, an NGO that aims to make public policy pro-people and sustainable. He said his organization welcomed the solar energy project.
However, I think that the mechanics need to be looked into, because government wants individual households to replace their own electric geysers with solar geysers. Maybe government should come up with a subsidy program affordable to many Zimbabweans, considering that the economic situation of the country is not that favorable.
By geyser, Kushera means water heater, which many middle and upper class Zimbabweans have in their homes. Undenge dismissed worries the solar program would be expensive to Zimbabweans. He said the government would install solar water heaters and gradually deduct the cost from consumers. The minister did not say how cash-strapped Zimbabwe is going to pay for the solar heaters. He said the government has ordered ZESA to import the heaters from China and then advised how much assistance the utility expects from the central government. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
The United Nations 70th General Assembly in New York has set a record this year for the number of leaders attending. The speeches and the dignitaries capture much of the world's attention. VOA's Alberto Pimienta at the United Nations gives us a behind-the-scenes look at journalists covering the meeting.
In an exercise of precise diplomatic choreography, the world's eyes are centered on the UN. But for reporters from every corner of the planet, it is all but organized.
As a journalist, this is actually my 16th UN General Assembly, but the one thing you can guarantee every year is it's complete chaos. Every year you see journalists melt down. I've seen tears, I've seen fits, anger, but people can still keep on coming.
More than 4,000 journalists applied for credentials to cover the General Assembly this year. But getting those credentials is not always easy.
The worst thing for journalists is when they've flown in from a country, sometimes thousands of miles away, you know, 24 hours traveling, they have to line up and get one of these. And these badges, you can't move anywhere without them. And sometimes the lines are 6, 12, 24 hours long. Last year, people were camping overnight.
However, this year was different.
If you include, in fact, the reporters and also the delegates, just the sheer number of passes that had to be issued just in the last few weeks was, I believe, 12,000. So it's a lot to do, and you had to space it out so that you don't have, you know, lines out the door day after day.
TV studios are set up on the streets, with correspondents broadcasting to all over the world. Reporters scrambling to make deadlines. Sidewalks become offices. There's barely time to eat. It never stops from early in the morning to the wee hours of the night. Even though they travel from faraway places to New York, there is not time to be a tourist.
We were busy working and we don't have time to go and do, to see United States, but it's good.
And like it was never here, over the weekend, everything goes back to normal. Everyone goes home. Alberto Pimienta for VOA News, United Nations.
Somalia's Al-Shabaab militant group has moved to quell dissenting voices suspected of supporting the so-called Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. The group recently issued an order banning individuals from making pro-Islamic State statements and speeches. But experts say dissenters may be using the debate over affiliation as a cover to express other grievances within the group. Kenneth Mehouse is professor of political science at Davidson College in North Carolina and an expert on Somalia affairs.
In many ways, the affiliation of al-Shabaab with either ISIS or al-Qaeda is not terribly significant because the movement doesn't get that much support from either one. In the past, it has been the case that internal dissenters within al-Shabaab have used the debate over affiliation as a way to provide themselves cover. This is a legitimate Islamist position to argue for an affiliation with ISIS instead of al-Qaeda. That's really been a camouflage for broader divisions within the leadership of al-Shabaab. The fact that they appear to have arrested foreigners in southern Somalia suggests that this might also have a Somali versus the non-Somali dimension to it that we've seen in the past with al-Shabaab.
And do you think that al-Shabaab will be able to silence these dissenting voices again?
I don't. I think that the movement has been riddled with internal tensions and divisions for a number of years. They're not going to go away. I think the debate over affiliation with ISIS is also going to remain. ISIS is ascendant compared to al-Qaeda. It has more appeal among some jihadis, and I think we can expect to see this go on. The movement's also had to decentralize somewhat in response to the offensives against it, and that makes it, of course, harder for leadership to exercise tight control.
Why do you think Al-Shabaab leadership is very strict on sticking with Al-Qaeda in comparison to ISIS?
I think that may have to do with personal connections and commitments more than anything else. But to be honest, I don't know if any of us can say with authority what the answer is on those kinds of internal questions within Al-Shabaab.
What do you make of how the new leader of Al-Shabaab ran the organization so far?
So far, the understanding by on the part of outsiders is that he has not been a particularly strong leader. He is facing internal dissent. He may or may not have control over all of the policies and even attacks of the organization. But he hasn't given us a whole lot to work with. He's been relatively quiet in his pronouncements.
Kenneth Meckhouse is professor of political science at Davidson College in North Carolina and an expert on Somalia affairs. He was speaking with reporter Haroon Maruf of VOA Somali Service. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Ethiopia edged their hosts Botswana 3-2 in Gaborone on Wednesday. The friendly match was part of Botswana's Independence Day celebrations. Meanwhile, the 2018 FIFA World Cup qualifier between the Central African Republic and Madagascar will be staged in Madagascar, the FIFA disclosed in Zurich, Switzerland on Wednesday. According to FIFA, the Central African Republic cannot host the first leg in their capital, Bangui, owing to security concerns. FIFA says that by mutual consent, the two national football federations agree that both legs of their qualifier will be played in the Madagascar capital, Antananarivo. The first leg will be played on the 10th of October and the return leg 3 days later. Moving on to basketball, defending champions Angola tackled Gabon in the quarterfinals of the Africa Women's Basketball Championships in Yaounde, Cameroon today, Thursday. Mozambique challenged Nigeria, Egypt faced Cameroon, and Senegal encounter Mali. In classification matches, South Africa play Guinea as Algeria engage Uganda. In Rwanda, South Sudan is set to make their maiden appearance in the Africa Zone 5 Basketball Club Championships in Kigali. The Rwanda Basketball Federation Secretary General Richard Mutabazi told the Kigali media on Wednesday. He says South Sudan's National Engineering and Logistics Basketball Club is entered for the men's contest. The annual regional event, which starts next Sunday, will feature 11 men and 7 women's teams from Burundi, Egypt, Ethiopia, Kenya, South Sudan, Sudan, Tanzania, Uganda, and hosts Rwanda. Burundi's Urunani are men's defending champions and aim for a third consecutive triumph, while Kenya's United States International University are the women's champions. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Burkina Faso's government says it is trying to convince the general behind a recent short-lived coup to surrender a day after he sought refuge in an embassy in the capital. In a statement Wednesday, the government said negotiations are underway for the surrender of General Gilbert Diendere to transitional authorities. The statement did not specify which embassy he was in, but Reuters News reports that he is in the Vatican compound in Ouagadougou. And alleged Islamist radical accused of helping to destroy historic buildings in Mali made his first appearance at the International Criminal Court on Wednesday. That's it for this Thursday, October 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford and reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Oldman, I'm James Barty in Washington saying have a lovely day.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. On Saturdays, tune in at 3:30 and 14:30 UTC. And on Sundays at 5:30 and 17:30 UTC. Or subscribe to the Encounter podcast. Just go to our homepage at voanews.com and click on podcasts. Also, we love to hear from you. Send an email to encounter@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/Carol Castiel VOA. That's Encounter on VOA Africa.